Russian strikes on Ukraine's power grid have been relentless. People in the capital are often without electricity or heat. They're gathering together for warmth and solidarity.
They're cooking by a flame and they're staying together by a flame. And that sense of community, I think, really helps people keep their spirits up.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Also, it's been more than 3 months since the Trump administration brokered a ceasefire in Gaza. On the ground, peace feels very distant.
I think it would be dishonest to say that the war has stopped as such.
Plus, Venezuelans tell us how they're feeling about U.S. intervention.
If that's like the less bad thing that we're going to have, okay, we have to deal with that later.
And what happens with viruses when they go to space? That's all ahead today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for coming along with us this Thursday. We start today's program in Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, where a harsh winter is gripping the city, and power and heat are only sometimes available. That's because of relentless Russian drone and missile attacks.
Earlier this week, 70% of the capital was without power. President Volodymyr Zelensky has now declared a state of emergency in the energy sector. Jared Goyette is an editor in the newsroom at the Kyiv Independent. We spoke earlier this afternoon.
There's no heat. We have some portable heater set up in the newsroom, but everyone in the newsroom has their full winter coats on as they're working, hats on, and I'm trying to wrap myself in a blanket.
Oh, wow. And has it been like that all week?
Yeah. After the last massive attack, there was a pretty severe drop-off in and heat and electricity. And the nights get difficult. People are using, you know, heating water and putting it like under their sheets to stay warm, or heating bricks. You know, I think when people lose water and heat, I mean, electricity is bad. You want to have electricity. Don't get me wrong. But when you lose water and heat in winter, that gets really hard to live through.
Yeah. How cold is it there right now?
It's 7 degrees Fahrenheit.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So how else are people trying to stay warm? You mentioned heating up water, bricks, anything else?
Stay moving. I've seen people cooking outside and staying in groups. I think it all becomes easier when you stay with like groups of friends, so you're not like, or family, or just these random gatherings that happen of like, you know, winter outdoor barbecues, which may sound like a weird thing that people do, but they're cooking by a flame and they're staying together by a flame. And that sense of community, I think, really helps people keep their spirits up and push through, because, I mean, that's part of the point of this, right? The large attack happened right before temperatures dropped. That wasn't a coincidence. The idea was to, you know, destroy morale. But I've been surprised by the degree to do it that, which that has not happened. Mm. You know, people, they're angry, but that anger is directed at Russia.
The last big attack you're mentioning, was that the attack on Friday?
Yeah, that was the attack on Friday. That was a really rough night. What's been odd since then is that there's been regular drone attacks during the day. Normally, they save those for night, but they seem to be trying to disrupt repair efforts.
So on Friday, Russia hit transformer and substations in and around Kyiv. That's the infrastructure that gets power generated elsewhere into Kyiv. It then also hit all three natural gas and coal-burning power plants in Kyiv, which shut down internally produced sources of heat and electricity. And since then, you're saying that drone strikes have been targeting repair efforts.
Yes. Telegram channels were reporting one just like a few hours ago that hit a thermal power plant. There's also been an uptick in the use of jet-powered Shahed-type drones, which are faster and harder to shoot down.
Mm. President Zelensky just declared a state of emergency in the energy sector. Will that bring any relief? What does that actually mean in practical terms?
It seems that there's like a more of a concerted effort to coordinate planning and response. It's more of a case of streamlining decision making and making the response as quick as possible. You know, you had one point, you had almost 70% of Kyiv that was like knocked out of power.
Right.
The heat outages are widespread. It at least shows that the government is acting urgently because, you know, when you think about the particularly the vulnerable populations in terms of senior citizens or people with disabilities, you know, this could become a grave humanitarian situation.
I know a lot of people in Kyiv live in these giant apartment towers and the elevators go out when there's no electricity. So are people just walking up and down like dozens and dozens of flights of steps every day?
Yeah, that's easy for me. But yesterday I I passed an older woman who was struggling a bit. Like, she was grimacing, and I wanted to help her, but I couldn't. I worry about her, and mm-hmm. I worry about the thousands of people like her.
Yeah.
It kind of also feels like a little bit of a gamble every time if you do try to use an elevator when there is electricity, because it could die while you're in there.
You might get stuck.
Yeah. So, like, if you're feeling risky, you know, it could be your little diversion for the night. Take the elevator, see what happens.
So we have been hearing and reporting about power outages and heat outages in Ukraine for, I guess this is the fourth winter now, but it sounds to me like you're describing something that does feel different than previous winters.
Yeah, and the people that I've talked to have described this, yeah, like, this is the worst that it's ever been. Yeah, I think it's a combination of this being a particularly hard winter in terms of temperature. Like, mm-hmm. this is just colder than it was last winter. That wind chill is there. There's ice everywhere. And a more systematic effort. The front lines are moving very fast. And it seems like Russia is focusing its attention on just picking apart Ukraine's energy infrastructure in a way that would impact as many civilians as possible, as egregiously as possible.
When do temperatures start warming up in Ukraine?
Probably March can still be pretty cold. Mm-hmm. But April will start to warm up. What people have, you know, been saying is that February is going to be tough.
Yeah.
Because February is usually the coldest month. And we're not even there yet. And these last, you know, week has probably been like the hardest winter week in Kyiv since the start of the war. And we're at January 15th.
So here in the newsroom, we've seen photos of teenagers in stationary train cars set up for them to just, what, get together and huddle in warmth?
Yeah, the city's been setting that up. It ended up, I think, being a pretty good idea, because a lot of the teenagers we spoke to were like, oh, this seems cool. So you're getting them to come together to actually use the space. And importantly for everyone, they had free hot tea. Ukrainians love their tea, and they were taking advantage of it. I think one of the key coping mechanisms is people coming together. People are like gathering and keeping each other warm, like figuratively and literally. Mm-hmm. It's also what's keeping morale up, I think.
Yeah.
You know, we're seeing difficult times, but we're seeing people adapt to them.
Jared Goyette is an editor with the Kyiv Independent. He spoke with us earlier today about how residents in the Ukrainian capital are coping after repeated Russian attacks on the city's energy infrastructure.
Venezuela's top opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado, had lunch with President Trump at the White House today. Her political party was widely seen as the winner of Venezuela's 2024 election. Nicolas Maduro, the recently deposed president, did not cede power. But since Maduro's ouster, Machado has been sidelined by Trump. From Caracas, the world's TBS Isaiah tells us how Venezuelans see it all.
For years, Maria Corina Machado has been the clearest face of Venezuela's democratic opposition.
Maria Corina Machado was a great leader in 2024 when she basically gave people hope again in the election process.
That's Alejandra Otero, a young journalist here in Caracas. She says Machado did something the opposition hadn't managed in years. She convinced people that their votes could bring change, even in a system they didn't trust.
That's a really great achievement. She united the country towards the vote. And I think that was a beautiful experience in our democratic history.
Otero didn't just vote. She was a poll worker.
I counted the votes one by one. And it was like one of the most important things that I have ever lived in this country. It was beautiful. But then we had the shocking and terrible news.
The news was that Maduro had stolen the election. Luckily, Machado had organized civil society to defend their votes.
I think she did a really great work uniting people, and then in the aftermath, having the receipts, the tallies, and publishing them, you see that indeed the government lost, and we had all the proof.
That work was a major reason Machado later won the Nobel Peace Prize. But over the past year, Machado's strategy has become more controversial. She worked hard to win President Trump's favor. She backed his push for military action and stayed silent after U.S. strikes in the Caribbean killed more than 100 people. She supported Trump's exaggerated claims about drugs coming from Venezuela and also avoided criticism of U.S. immigration policies affecting hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans. She even offered to share her Nobel Prize with Trump, something Otero didn't like.
I personally do not like her speech towards Donald Trump because I don't think we have to look for another savior for our justice and democratic processes. I don't like the fact that she offered the Nobel Prize to him.
The Nobel Prize Institute told Machado that she's not allowed to share her prize. Otero also questions why Machado hasn't talked much about the people killed in the U.S. attack.
I mean, we're talking about human lives. We're talking about people's homes. It's not collateral damage to them or their families. And I know that the people that died were military personnel, but I mean, they're people.
About 100 people died, according to the Venezuelan government. Most Venezuelans don't welcome the idea of foreign military intervention, but many say they ran out of options. Adrián Bartos is a photographer and film director in Caracas.
Creo que es que hemos buscado tantas salidas y tantas posibilidades de protesta, o elección democrática, negociaciones, todas se las burlaron.
We tried everything, he says. Protests, elections, negotiations, the UN, the International Criminal Court, and every path was blocked. We felt like a U.S. intervention was the only option left, he says. For Bartos, Machado deserves credit for pushing for that until the end, even when it damaged how some people see her. A doctor in Caracas says he supports Machado, but this is not the right time for her to return.
Entendí que lo que está buscando el gobierno de Trump es...
I understand why the Trump administration is excluding her for now, he says. She doesn't have the support of the armed forces, and that could create chaos. But others who supported Machado say she should come back soon. A taxi driver who asked not to be named says she's been disconnected from Venezuelans on the ground because she had to remain in hiding for so long and now is in exile. He says he wanted to hear Machado talking to Venezuelans after she was sidelined by Trump, not to American journalists in English. Now, with Trump engaging instead with Maduro's former allies, many Venezuelans are not celebrating.
No quiero que haya más bombardeo, no quiero que haya más nada de eso. Esa no
Marta Marín says she doesn't want more bombing in her country, but rather a push for a democratic transition now that Maduro is out. President Trump seems to be very happy working with acting leader Delcy Rodriguez, a close Maduro ally.
And she's a terrific person. I mean, she's somebody that we've worked with very well. Marco Rubio is dealing with her. I dealt with her this morning. We had a call, a long call. We discussed a lot of things, and I think we're getting along very well with Venezuela. Yeah.
Marín fears Trump will only focus on his own interest and won't prioritize democracy in Venezuela. Still, most people I talk to in Caracas say their country is now in a better situation than it was before the U.S. attack. Even government supporters say they want free and fair elections. A recent Economist poll found that 80% of Venezuelans believe President Trump offers a better future for the country. Otero says she worries about Trump's anti-democratic tendencies.
Well, I think he doesn't respect institutions at all, but it's like you have a bad and a greater bad, you know? If that's like the less bad thing that we're going to have, okay, we have to deal with that later.
How Maria Corina Machado will be part of that future remains unclear, but many Venezuelans still see her as a symbol of their democratic values and hopes. Someone who is committed to a free Venezuela by any means. For the world, I'm Tibisay Sea in Caracas, Venezuela.
Mm-hmm. Most cars for sale in East Africa are used cars that run on gas. One Kenyan company wants to change that. That story's coming up. You're listening to The World.
Right now, we are living through some of the most tumultuous political times our country has ever known. I'm David Remnick, and each week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll try to make sense of what's happening alongside politicians and thinkers like Cory Booker, Nancy Pelosi, Liz Cheney, Tim Walz, Ketanji Brown Jackson, Newt Gingrich, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Charlemagne the God, and so many more. That's all in the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Trump administration has made higher ed a punching bag since he came to office by, among other things, restricting student visas. When it comes to Harvard and other highly selective schools, though, this tactic is backfiring. Kirk Carapezza covers higher education for GBH Boston, and he's been tracking the numbers.
Harvard's global brand seems to have insulated it from some of the administration's actions targeting foreign students. This academic year, Harvard enrolled nearly 7,000 international students. They make up nearly a third of the student body, and that's the highest share in more than 20 years.
So what's behind those numbers? This is kind of surprising.
Yeah, I spoke with Clay Harmon for this story. He directs the Association of International Enrollment Management. And Harmon says even amid federal policy shifts like travel bans, visa restrictions, and this crackdown on protests, free speech, and academic freedom, American colleges in general, and the Harvard name in particular, still carry enormous weight abroad.
Even if a prospective student were ambivalent about coming to the United States, if they were to be admitted to Harvard, there's a very likely chance that they would be more willing to go for that institution than some other institution in the U.S.
Okay, so what about other colleges and universities across the country, Kirk, that attract many students from abroad? What's happening elsewhere?
Yeah, so while these selective schools continue to attract students from overseas, first-year international enrollment is down 17% nationwide. That's according to the Institute of International Education. It did a survey this fall and found 60% of institutions reported declines in international enrollment. Now, other less formal surveys put that figure closer to 80%. And of course, most higher education in the U.S. happens at public institutions. And that's also true for international education. So Harvard, Columbia, Berkeley, these brand name schools, they're getting hammered by the Trump administrations and they're constantly in the crosshairs. But they appear far better positioned to weather the current political storm than these regional public universities or even small private colleges.
Kirk, what do academic leaders you're speaking with make of all this?
Many say it's damaging the global reputation of American higher education. It's creating a chilling effect on campuses that affects both international and domestic students. There's a new report released today by PEN America, and it finds government censorship of free speech and economic freedom has reached unprecedented levels on U.S. campuses. This report finds that more than half of college students in the U.S. now study in a state with at least one law or policy restricting what can be taught or how campuses can operate.
Yeah, and what are the consequences of that?
Yeah, these state laws, federal investigations, executive orders, and tweets from President Trump have really silenced students, professors, and even college presidents. PEN America's Amy Reed says the Trump administration has weaponized government power to coerce colleges into meeting its ideological demands on things like diversity, equity, and inclusion.
We're all in this together. Censorship in one state, censorship on the federal level, it impacts all of us one way or another.
And Reed says her concern goes well beyond America's reputation abroad. She worries about whether students, both American and international, can access an education free from government censorship and free from the kinds of policies that restrict international students from studying here in the U.S.
Kirk Carapezza covers higher education in Boston and beyond. He also hosts the GBH podcast, College Uncovered. Kirk, thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
In Kenya, a group of engineers is working on a new option for car buyers. They're developing the country's first ever locally assembled electric vehicle. The world's transportation correspondent Jeremy Siegel brings us the story of TAD Motors.
As a kid growing up in Kenya, Brian Arasa was always fascinated by cars, how they were built and where they were built.
But one question that always came into my mind, are we able to actually do this here in Kenya?
For decades, the answer to that question has simply been no. Roughly 80% of cars in Kenya are cheap old internal combustion vehicles shipped in from other parts of the world, mostly Japan. Arasa never thought he'd live to see a Kenyan-made electric car hit the market. That is, until he got hired by TAD Motors a few months back.
It's really, really amazing. And it's also a dream that I didn't think that it was to come that soon to us.
TAD Motors is the brainchild and namesake of Tedese Tesema, an Ethiopian-born engineer who spent most of his career in the Netherlands and has a knack for first-ever business ventures. In 1997, he helped develop the Netherlands' first hybrid bus. Then, in 2005, he started the first car assembly plant in Ethiopia. So it makes sense that Tesema almost comes across overconfident as he tells me about his latest effort to turn Kenya's automobile culture on its head.
A car is not rocket science.
Not rocket science, sure, but a homegrown Kenyan car is a tall order, one with a rocky history. In the 1980s, the Kenyan government tried to launch its own locally made car brand called Nyayo, but it never went into production due to funding issues. Tesema says it's been tough to convince authorities and investors that his company will somehow work.
You know, it's very, very difficult, even if you have the best idea, whatever you think. It's very difficult to get financing for the project.
As a result, TAD Motors is mostly funded by friends, family, old co-workers, and Tesema himself. It's a risk for sure, but Tesema's not concerned, he says, because TAD has a silver bullet of sorts. Their electric cars, especially the compact cars, are remarkably cheap.
We are coming with a price range of $10,000. So there is no company, even in China, who can make these cars for this amount of price.
With the way Kenya's financing works, Tesema says that makes TAD's cheapest model as affordable as a used import. That model is a no-frills vehicle with a small battery. Its driving range per charge is only about 150 miles, roughly half of what you'd get from a Tesla or BYD. But Tesema says in East Africa, that's all people really want and need.
Normal people, they drive within a day between 50 and 70 kilometers. The main part of the EV vehicle, which makes it very expensive, is the battery. So minimizing the things which are not necessary for daily use, we have managed to reduce the price this much.
Still, experts caution that a low range could be problematic in a country like Kenya, where EV infrastructure doesn't really exist.
Charging stations are few and far between.
That's Hamna Tariq, a research associate at the Energy for Growth Hub.
Kenya has this goal of having 10,000 charging stations by 2030, I can't tell you if that they're going to meet that goal. What I can tell you from our analysis, Kenya only had 40 public charging stations a year and a half ago, and building 10,000 more in the next few years seems a little bit improbable.
On top of that, Kenya has major struggles with grid reliability and frequently experiences prolonged blackouts. But Tariq says that doesn't mean you should count out startups like TAD. If more EVs are sold, it could inspire officials to improve infrastructure.
I am excited to see how TAD Motors actually implements this and how they start selling it.
TAD, for its part, says it won't be too long before you do see. The company is currently developing an assembly plant near Nairobi and plans to begin producing fleets of ultra-cheap EVs in March. After that, the hope is to make bigger vehicles, vans, trucks, and buses, because TAD says that is where the real profit is. For The World, I'm Jeremy Siegel.
Ahead on the show, they're like rivers in the sky. How scientists are learning to forecast atmospheric rivers better. They're with The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. It looks like, for now anyway, any possible U.S. military strike on Iran is on hold. President Trump told reporters last night that informed sources have told him the killings in Iran have stopped and that the government there will refrain from executing protesters. The communications blackout does continue, however. For almost a week, Iran has been cut off from the internet. Calls into Iran won't go through either. Even so, the world's Shirin Jafari has been able to reach people inside the country.
There was a sense of calm before the storm last Thursday as this Tehran resident visited his friend.
Everything was as usual. And I couldn't imagine that in a few minutes later, the population will explode.
By 8 p.m., he says, the crowd started to gather. And a half an hour later, it was as if the floodgates had opened.
We walked to the main street to see what's happening. Too many people. It was unbelievable, really. Old, young, women, men, children, you know, was out and they were shouting.
They were shouting, the supreme leader must go, he says, and this is the end of the regime. Tehran is no stranger to protests, but this was unlike anything this resident had ever seen before. Everyone I spoke with for this story requested anonymity. They fear retribution by the government. This man says at first the atmosphere was relaxed, but then on Friday things started to escalate. Security forces showed up in force.
And suddenly two or three tear gas, you know, was shot toward the crowd. But people didn't run away, just relocate, you know.
The protesters remained on the streets, he says, undeterred. Seemingly caught off guard, the government scrambled to respond. It shut down all communications.
The protest started at 8. At 9, everything was locked.
No one could get online. Cell phone connections were cut off, he says. This was to stop protesters from organizing. Then, over the weekend, the crackdown escalated, says another eyewitness. He says the security guards were present across the city.
They were fully masked. They were holding a different sets of weapons, big anti-protest tanks, black tanks, bins on fire. I slept to the sounds of gunshots just about every night in that last week that I was there.
Both of these men have managed to leave Iran in recent days. They, along with others I spoke with, described scenes of chaos and intense crackdown by the government.
In one instance, there was a group of protesters hacking at cement and another group that was throwing it at the security guards, and it was like a human chain of effort.
Human rights groups say the death toll in the uprisings in Iran is in the thousands. The government continues to air footage of bodies in body bags as a way to deter protesters. Some of the victims have been identified. A 23-year-old fashion designer who dreamed of moving to Milan to pursue her studies in fashion. A former champion bodybuilder, an architect father of two, a 17-year-old student, among many others. The communications blackout has made it almost impossible to reach anyone inside Iran. But with the help of Nima Fatemi, I managed to reach some of them. Fatemi is based in the U.S. and heads a nonprofit called Can Do. It provides cybersecurity services to vulnerable populations. This protester says he saw security forces fire on the crowd. I saw many killed, he says. Out of three or four families in my community, at least one knows someone who has been killed. It's a tragedy, he says. This woman says she too knows people who have been killed. Some have been arrested or disappeared, she says. Others have injuries to their eyes, a familiar tactic used by the security forces. The level of brutality is unimaginable, she says. She says the crackdown has sent some protesters home. They're starting to feel disillusioned, she says, after President Trump walked away from providing any military assistance. But the underlying issues remain. One of the men who left Iran says the country's runaway inflation was evident in his visit to a sandwich shop in Tehran.
and a man comes in and asks to order 3 omelette sandwiches for 6 p.m. And in response, the shop owner says, "I'm sorry, I won't know what the price of eggs will be at 6, so you're going to have to call me 20 minutes before. I won't sell it to you now."
The falling currency, repression, and lack of social freedoms are all reasons behind the recent protests. Iranians are risking their lives for a better future, he says.
It's horrifying that kids my age, kids younger than me, their grandmothers, some of them are mothers and fathers of all sorts. And, you know, you just can't help but think they're not asking for something unreasonable. They're asking for anything reminiscent of some human rights.
While Trump says the Iranian authorities have assured him protesters won't be executed, this Tehran resident worries about the days ahead.
They have arrested too many people, too many young people, innocent people, and they easily execute all of them, easily.
When the dust settles, he says, people will be left with a wounded tiger. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Around the world, a major driver of catastrophic flooding is a phenomenon you may or may not have heard of, atmospheric rivers. Scientists in Europe are trying to learn more about them. Today, they launched the region's first ever research flights to help. Marty Ralph is an expert on atmospheric rivers at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. He said they're essentially rivers of water vapor in the sky pushed by the wind.
They're a natural part of the weather patterns when you get low-pressure systems in the winter, like a nor'easter or a west coast storm. It sort of ends up converging the water vapor into a relatively narrow region where there's also strong winds, and they transport a heck of a lot of water.
And so when we have big, heavy rains that last for a while, that is sometimes due to an atmospheric river. Is that right?
Right. Particularly on the west coast of Europe or the U.S., Western Chile, Western South America, Western Australia, New Zealand, very tip of South Africa. Antarctica gets hit by ARs. Hmm. These atmospheric rivers can be the primary source of the heaviest rainfall throughout the year and cause most of the flooding.
And I only started hearing this term maybe a few years ago. Is one reason we're hearing more about them now linked to climate change? Like, are they expected or already getting more intense?
There's a lot of reasons to be hearing about them. One is that we expect as the atmosphere warms that it can hold more water vapor. So when there's an atmospheric river, it's basically got more fuel. Another reason we're hearing about them a lot now is drought is a really big issue in the Western U.S. and frankly, in other parts of the world as well. And ARs are often what help us get out of drought.
And ARs, the acronym you're using, is atmospheric rivers, I assume?
AR is short for atmospheric river.
So let's get to the news on this that's happening this week. French and German teams have just set up their first research flights to study atmospheric rivers. Tell me what this actually looks like. Do you fly right into a storm?
So the flights that we do are designed to fly above the storms, essentially, very high up in the stratosphere. And we work up there to look downward into the storms using radars and other sensors. We drop a little sensor package with a little parachute, and as it falls down, it radios back to the airplane temperature, pressure, wind, and moisture. Mm. So these are ways to sort of like do an MRI of an AR by seeing its inner workings, from an aircraft-based sampling strategy.
And I was reading that atmospheric rivers are one of the major sources of uncertainty in forecasts writ large. Is that accurate?
Yeah, atmospheric rivers are really important for getting the forecast right because they produce a lot of the precipitation. If you don't get that right, it really louses up the forecast later.
So, I can understand why this might be annoying if you didn't bring your umbrella or something and it rains, but are there bigger stakes here? I mean, we've been talking about catastrophic flooding. Like, what happens because our forecasts on these are not that good?
There are multiple problems. People don't know what's coming. They can't prepare for it. If it's extreme precipitation, which is what ARs can deliver in some cases, those can be damaging, even life-threatening. And if we have better lead time and understand where they might hit and how strong they're going to be, it allows people who are responsible for preparing communities for evacuations or for protecting property, they have time to take action. That's our goal from a public safety standpoint.
There's a lot of weather and climate data that there's a lot better data in well-resourced places like the U.S. and Europe than in other places, and that can lead to real impacts on the ground. Are the forecasts just much worse in developing countries for atmospheric rivers?
It's an interesting question. As you get into regional storm types and conditions, extra effort in those regions can make the forecast and does make the forecast better for that region in particular. I want to point out, though, in the case of this atmospheric river reconnaissance, if we can sample the three atmospheric rivers that are usually present, sometimes four, one in the Western Pacific, one in the Central or Eastern Pacific, one off the East Coast of the U.S., maybe one off the West Coast of Europe. If we can sample all of those with our AR recon aircraft measurements, we could reduce the uncertainty in the forecast, not just of a few days ahead for one part of the Northern Hemisphere, but potentially for 2 weeks ahead for the whole Northern Hemisphere.
Wow.
It's a hypothesis. There's a lot of reasons it might not work, but there's a lot of reasons it might. And we now have our first chance to really help everybody in the Northern Hemisphere, no matter what part of the hemisphere you're in.
That was Marty Ralph with Scripps Institution of Oceanography.
The Trump administration says it's time to move to phase two of its Gaza peace plan. This includes putting together a new 15-member technocratic committee for running Palestinian affairs in the territory. But lots of questions remain. Earlier today, I spoke with Khaled El-Gindi from the Quincy Institute in Washington. He walked me through what's involved with phase two of the Trump-brokered peace plan.
Well, the main pieces are almost everything that comes after a cessation of hostilities, and that is reconstruction in Gaza, rehabilitation, security, also the issue of disarming Hamas. To what extent, what does that mean, and how will it be carried out? And just sort of beginning the process of rehabilitating Gaza after what was obviously a devastating war that destroyed pretty much everything.
Now, do all the requirements of phase one have to be met so the parties can move on to phase two? And have they been met? Cessation of hostilities, Israel pulling forces back to a designated rear line, hostage remains returned.
Yeah, they haven't fully been met. I mean, on the hostage side, I think there is only one remaining deceased, the remains of a deceased Israeli soldier, I believe, that haven't been returned. To put that in perspective, though, there are approximately 10,000 Palestinians buried in the rubble. So it's a very difficult endeavor to try to locate the remains of that remaining Israeli. The other things have also not really been happening. We have not seen a full cessation of hostilities. Israel is bombing and sniping and carrying out various attacks across the Gaza Strip almost daily. There's ongoing destruction. And also, we have not seen levels of humanitarian aid that are required under the ceasefire entering Gaza. So it definitely makes it much more difficult to get to phase two.
So Hamas signed off on the Trump peace plan, but the group has not agreed to give up its weapons, which is one of the requirements of phase two. So how's this going to work now?
That's one of the many million-dollar questions. How is disarmament going to work? How is reconstruction going to work? How are you going to bring in an international stabilization force? Who is going to be part of that force? What is the relationship of that force to the Israeli military? Where will they be deployed? These are all open questions that have not been worked out.
And answers to those questions are still unclear?
Right. Yeah, they haven't begun to negotiate the details of those. But like I said, I think they're not insurmountable, provided there is good faith on all sides. It's not clear that Netanyahu is interested in phase two, and is in fact, he called the White House's announcement that we've entered phase two a symbolic gesture. Mm. So that gives you a sense of the seriousness or lack thereof with which he's taking this issue.
So Gaza native and former Palestinian Authority Deputy Minister Ali Shaath has been tapped to head this technocratic committee. What do we know about him?
Well, he was a deputy minister of planning at one point. He is, I think, well regarded by people that I've spoken to, people inside and outside of Gaza, people from the UN system who worked with him speak highly of him. It's important to note that he and the other names that are on this list, this technocratic committee, were names that were vetted by all Palestinian factions, including Hamas. And so the fact that they're okay with it, that the PA is on board, that they have generally, I think, the credibility with local Palestinians in Gaza, that's a good sign.
And Shoth said in a recent interview, quote, "We are not talking about reconstruction, but construction anew in Gaza." Khalid, first of all, where are things at on the ground in Gaza? Is it ready to see phase two ramp up?
Well, I think the people are definitely ready, because once you begin phase two, it will mean that phase one will have to be settled. It means there will have to be an end to bombing and destruction and limiting aid. I think that's designed to give the local population some hope that a page has been turned, that we're entering a new phase, that we can put Gaza's worst days behind them.
Just going back to what the head of this technocratic committee has said, Ali Shaath, about construction anew, could you just elaborate on that rhetorical phrasing? What is the overall vision he's alluding to?
The vision, I think, is to not just rebuild Gaza in terms of brick and mortar and roads and infrastructure, but to chart a new path for Gaza as a whole, which is not just a technical exercise. It's not a logistical exercise. It is ultimately a political exercise. And I think that is built into that kind of language. And that is, it is time to turn the page, to focus on not just rebuilding physical structures, but to rebuild life, to rebuild a civic life, to rebuild social institutions, cultural institutions. That's something that has been devastated and almost wiped out entirely in Gaza. And so I really think that it's a statement that is designed to give hope to 2 million people right now in extremely dire straits and very easy to fall into a state of despair.
Yes, so that's interesting. In some ways, then, do you think it makes sense to focus the parties on phase two, announcing it, even if requirements of phase one have not been met, even just to focus the mind?
I think it's a tactic in politics that and in diplomacy that is not uncommon and has been known in circumstances to work. And that is, if you declare something to be true, then it gives everyone an incentive to try to make it true. Mm. The success of all of this depends on the Trump administration. Are they interested in the headline of a ceasefire and phase one and phase two, or are they interested in actually changing realities on the ground? And if it's the latter, then it's fine to announce something before it actually materializes, because it creates pressure and momentum toward that objective. But if the goal is just for the headline, then people will get disillusioned very quickly and we could start to see things unravel.
Khalid El-Ghindi is a Middle East policy expert with the Quincy Institute in Washington. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Space does funny things to the human body. With changes in gravity, astronauts experience muscle atrophy, a loss of bone mass, even a slight lengthening of the spine. But space doesn't just affect people, it also affects viruses. That's something we know now because researchers at the University of Wisconsin-Madison sent microbes to space to learn about what happens. Vatsan Raman is the lead author of that research. He described what inspired the study.
These bacteriophages, which are viruses that infect bacteria, are among the simplest biological entities on Earth. We were wondering, how does space affect human behavior, right? And the microbiome, which is a collection of microbes that lives within us, is super important for, you know, sort of human wellness. And, you know, as we start thinking about long-term space travel and, you know, sending astronauts to ISS, we've been sending them for a long time, and the role of the microbiome becomes an important factor, and how does that change in microgravity becomes an important factor. And so we said, you know, wouldn't it be cool if we can send some samples up to the International Space Station?
So we'll get to how you went about studying all this and what you actually saw, but we probably should start with a little knowledge of how those phages you're talking about and bacteria behave right here on Earth. So what typical microbial behavior here on Earth do the non-scientists among us need to understand before we hear what changes in zero gravity?
Yeah, so these bacteriophages are viruses, and just like human viruses infect humans, animal viruses infect animals, these are viruses that only infect bacteria. And then the way they normally work is they infect a bacterial cell or just a sort of an individual bacterium. They get inside, and then they make many, many copies of themselves. Sort of they reproduce inside the bacteria, and then they pop the bacteria open, and then they go on and infect other bacteria. So this is a very simple life cycle of a bacteriophage.
Mm.
And typically, the good ones can complete this life cycle in about 20 minutes.
So just before we go on, remind us of the difference between bacteria and viruses, and does your research have bearing on both?
So bacteria are single-celled organisms that are in the environment, that's within us too. Viruses are, again, biological entities that only have DNA, and there are many, many kinds of viruses. There are viruses that infect humans only, such as the flu virus and other types. And there are viruses that only infect bacteria, and those are called as bacteriophages, and they're smaller than a bacteria itself.
So for the study, you sent a box of microbes to the International Space Station. How do you actually do that?
So the space was a significant constraint. So all that you get is a tiny box, and you can fit your experiments into that box. And, you know, if any of you have sort of seen a biological laboratory, it is really quite big. So we had to then devise a scheme by which we, you know, mix the bacteriophages and the bacteria in at certain ratios in a tiny tube, and then freeze them in the lab, and then send them up to the International Space Station, and then have them do these experiments. The other constraint was, you know, what kinds of experiments could we have the astronauts do? I mean, their time is limited, and so, you know, it had to be very simple, and that was the other consideration that we had to keep in mind.
So explain in pretty simple terms how the experiment proceeds.
The way these experiments work is that we have bacteria and a bacteriophage that are mixed, and normally the bacteriophage completes its infection in about 20 minutes. And the key sort of factor to consider is, you know, between gravity and no gravity, the mixing properties of the liquid kind of changes. And so the way normally the bacteria and bacteriophage find each other is they sort of randomly move around in some liquid, and then they find each other. That's in normal gravity under terrestrial conditions. But in microgravity, this churn is very different, right? And how the mixing of liquid happens is very different. And so what we expected was that this would affect how quickly the infection event happens.
And you were saying that happens kind of like every 20 minutes on Earth.
Typically about 20 minutes. And on the International Space Station, it took hours to days for the infection to complete, which is sort of remarkable.
So that's really interesting. But your research in this experiment, it wasn't just about curiosity around how microbes operate in space. So what are the practical applications of this knowledge on Earth?
It was an interesting finding, which is somewhat serendipitous, I'd say, you know, because microgravity is a stressor, right? Just like any other stress, like heat or salt, it's a stress condition. And so both bacteria and bacteriophages adapt to those stresses by having mutations in them. So they change their DNA to better adapt to those conditions. And what was interesting was the bacteriophages picked up mutations in the International Space Station. And when we challenged them, took those bacteriophages and applied them, once we got the samples back and applied them on pathogenic bacteria on Earth, which is bacteria that cause urinary tract infection, the mutated bacteriophages were very effective at killing the pathogens on Earth, which I thought was quite compelling and was frankly quite surprising. And so this tells us that there's something about the microgravity condition that brings out these mutations, which enable the bacteriophages to kill pathogens on Earth. And so there's a big push now, independent of our study, there's a big push towards having alternative therapies to bacterial diseases.
So Vatsan, for us lay people, virus and bacteria, that equals illness. Could this offer any insight into medical treatments or responses to future pandemics even?
Bacterial diseases are a huge problem. You can almost sort of think of that as sort of a slow-moving pandemic. Bacteria have acquired resistance to all kinds of traditional antibiotics. And so the ones that used to work back in the clinic don't work anymore. And bacteriophages are considered sort of a new line of treatment where we can use them to kill these highly pathogenic bacteria. Now, it is not to say that you can go back and run these experiments over and over again to identify sort of therapeutic candidates in space. But the point is that we can take a regular bacteriophage on Earth, make modifications to them, and then apply them as therapies against bacterial diseases.
Vatsan Raman is a professor of biochemistry at the University of Wisconsin, Madison.
Before we let you go today, a little trip to Sao Tome and Principe, the island nation in the Atlantic off the west coast of Africa.
Sao Tome and Principe doesn't get a lot of geopolitical attention, and the country's artists are also not front of mind, even for African music aficionados. But that is changing in an age when old vinyl gets rediscovered and digitized for global consumption. This is from the band Sanga Zuda. The track is called Sono Sakua de Tema, from a new collection of songs from the islands that comes out in March. Leve, Leve, Volume 2, Sao Tome and Principe Sounds, 70s to 80s.
It was curated by French DJ Tom B, who picked material that touched on colonial struggles and life post-independence. These musicians worked at a time when they were connected to global influences, but isolated enough on their island home to create their own style. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more, fjc.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.